and never find his way back. The sensible thing to do was wait. He could yell and hope Woodrow Call responded, but Woodrow had been too dull to move off his guard post. He might be too dull to yell back. The lightning was coming closer, which offered a sort of solution. He could be patient, mark his course, and move from flash to flash. A few sprinkles of rain wet his face. He could tell from the way the sage smelled that a shower was coming. He could even hear the patter of rain not far to the west. For a moment he squatted, tucking his serape around him. If it was going to turn wet, he was ready. Then a bold streak of lightning split the sky. For a moment it lit the prairie bright as day. And yet Gus saw nothing familiar. No river, no campfire, no chaparral bush, no Call. No sooner had he wrapped his serape around him and got ready for the rain squall than he was up and walking fast through the sage. He had meant to wait. He was sensible to wait, and yet a feeling had come over him that told him to move. The feeling told him to run, in fact. He was already moving at a rapid trot, though he stopped for a moment to lower the hammer of his pistol. He didn't intend to shoot off his thumb like young Rip Green. Then he trotted on, just short of a run. As he trotted, Gus began to realize that he was scared. The feeling that came over him, that brought him to his feet and started him trotting, was fear. It was such an unexpected and unfamiliar feeling that he had not been able to put a name to it at first. Rarely since early childhood had he been afraid. Creaking boards in the old family barn made him think of ghosts, and he had avoided the barn even to the point of being stropped for a failure to do the chores when he was small. Since then, though, he had rarely seen anything that he feared. Once in Arkansas, he had come across a bear eating a dead horse and had worried a bit. He was unarmed at the time and was sensible enough to know that he was no match for a bear. But since he had got his growth, he had not encountered much that put real fear in him. Just that Arkansas bear. What had him breathing short and stumbling now was a sense that somebody was near. Somebody he couldn't see. When he suggested that the wolf might be an Indian, he had just been joshing Call. He had felt restless and wanted to take a stroll. If he turned up a gold mine, so much the better. He didn't seriously expect to kill an Indian, though. He had no desire to stumble onto a Comanche Indian or any other Indian just at that time. It had just been something to twit Call about. He had never seen a Comanche Indian, and could not work up enough of a picture of one to know what to expect, but he didn't suppose that a Comanche could be as large as that bear or as fierce either. Now, though, he was driven to trot through the darkness by an overpowering sense that somebody was near. And who could it be but a Comanche Indian? It wasn't Call. Being near Call wouldn't scare him. Yet he was near somebody. Somebody he didn't want to be near. Somebody who meant him harm. Shadrach and Bigfoot claimed to be able to smell Indians, and smell them from a considerable distance, but he didn't have that ability. All he could smell was the wet sage and the damp desert. It wasn't because he could smell that he knew somebody was near. It was a feeling, and a feeling that came from a part of him he didn't even know he had. What that part told him was run, move, get away, even though the night had now divided itself into two parts, the pitch-black part and the brilliantly lit part. The brilliantly lit part, of course, was the lightning flashes, which came more frequently and turned the plain so bright that Gus had to blink his eyes. Even then, the light stayed like a line inside his eye when the plain turned black again, so black that in his running he stumbled in a chaparral and almost fell once when he struck a patch of deep sand. It was just after the sand that the lightning began to strike so close and so constantly that Gus developed a new fear, which was that his gun barrel would draw the lightning and he would be cooked on the spot. There had been some close lightning 3 days back, and the rangers, Bigfoot particularly, had told several stories of men who had been cooked by lightning. Sometimes, according to Bigfoot, the lightning even cooked a horse underneath the man. Gus would have been willing now to risk getting himself and his horse both cooked if he could only have a horse underneath him in order to move faster. Just as he was thinking that thought, a great lightning bolt struck not 50 yards away, and in that moment of white brightness, Gus saw the somebody he had been fearing, the Indian with a great hump of muscle or gristle between his shoulders, a hump so heavy that the man's head bent slightly forward as he sat like a buffalo's. Buffalo Hump sat alone on a robe of some kind. He looked at Gus, with his heavy head bent and his great hump wet from the rain, as if he had been expecting his arrival. He was not more than 10 feet away, no farther than the badger had been, and his eyes were like stone. Buffalo Hump looked at Gus, and then the plain went black. In the blackness, Gus ran as he had never run before, right past where the Indian sat. Lightning streaked again, but Gus didn't turn for a second look. He ran. Something tore at his leg as he brushed a thorn bush, but he didn't slow his speed. In the line inside his eyes where the lightning stayed, there was the Comanche now, the great humpbacked Indian, the most feared man on the frontier. Gus had been so close that he could almost have jumped over the man. For all he knew, Buffalo Hump was following, bent on taking his hair. His only hope was speed. With such a hump to carry, the man might not be fast. Gus forgot everything but running. He wanted to get away from the man with the hump. If he could just run all night, maybe the rangers would wake up and come to his aid. He didn't know whether he was running toward the river or away from it. He didn't know if Buffalo Hump was following or how close he might be. He just ran, afraid to stop, afraid to yell. He thought of throwing away his gun in order to get a little more speed, but he didn't. He wanted something to shoot with if he were cornered or brought down. At the guard post behind the chaparral bush, Call alternated between being irritated and being worried. He was convinced his friend, who had no business leaving in the first place, was out on the plain somewhere, hopelessly lost. There was little hope of finding him before daylight, and then it was sure to be a humiliating business. Shadrach was an excellent tracker and could no doubt follow Gus's trail, but it would cost the troop delay and aggravation. Major Chevalier might fire Gus. Even fire Call, too, for having allowed Gus to wander off. Major Chevalier expected orders to be obeyed, and Call didn't blame him. He might tolerate some wandering on the part of the scouts, that was their job, but he wouldn't necessarily tolerate it on the part of a private. When the rain came, there was not much Call could do but hunch over and get wet. The bush was too thorny to crawl under, and he had no coat. The lightning was bright, and the thunder loud, but Call didn't feel fearful especially. The bright flashes at least allowed him to look around. In one of them he thought he saw a movement. He decided it was the wolf they had heard howling. It was in another brilliant flash that he saw Gus running. The plain went black again, so black that Call wasn't sure whether he had seen Gus or imagined him. Gus had been tearing along, running dead out. All Call could do was wait for the next flash. When it came, he saw Gus again, closer, and in that flash Call saw something else, the Comanche. The light died so quickly that Call thought he might have imagined the Indian, too. In the light, he had seen the great hump, a mass half as large as the weight of most men, and yet the man was running fast after Gus and had a lance in his hand. Call fired wildly in the general direction of the Indian. It was dark again before his gun sounded. He thought the shot might at least distract the man with the hump. In the next flash, though, Buffalo Hump had stopped and thrown the lance. Call just saw it, splitting the rain as it flew toward Gus, who was still running flat out, running for his life. Call fired again with his pistol this time. Maybe Gus would hear it and take heart, although that was a faint hope. The thunderclaps were so continuous that he scarcely heard the shot himself.
Call raised his rifle, determined to be ready when the next flash came and lit the prairie. But when the flash did come, the plain was empty. Buffalo Hump was gone. The hair stood up on Call's neck when he failed to see the humpback chief. The man had just vanished on an open plain. If he moved that fast, he could be anywhere. Call backed into the chaparral, mindless of the thorns, and waited. No man, not even a Comanche, could get through a clump of chaparral and attack him from the rear, certainly no man who had such a hump to carry. Then he remembered the lance in the air, splitting the rain. He didn't know if it had hit home. If it had, his friend Gus McCrae might be dead. Buffalo Hump might even have run up on him and scalped him, or dragged him off for torture. The last was such an awful thought that Call couldn't stay crouched in the thorn bush. He waited until the next flash. A fair wait, for the storm was passing on to the east and the lightning was diminishing, and then headed for where he had last seen Gus. Once the thunder quieted a little more, he meant to fire his pistol. Maybe the rangers would hear it if Gus couldn't. Maybe they would come to his aid in time to stop the humpback Comanche from killing Gus or dragging him off. Yet as he waited, Call had the feeling that help, if it came, would come too late. Probably Gus was already dead. Call had seen the lance in the air. Buffalo Hump didn't look like a man who would let fly with a lance just to miss.
When the flash came, not as bright as before, Carl saw that the plane was still empty. He began to walk toward the area where he had seen Gus. It was the direction of camp, anyway. He yelled Gus's name twice, but there was no answer. Again the hair stood up on his neck. Buffalo Hump could be anywhere. He might be crouched behind any sage bush, any clump of chaparral, waiting in the dark for the next unwary ranger to walk by. Carl didn't intend to be an unwary ranger. He meant to take every precaution. But what precaution could you take on an empty plane at night with a dangerous Indian somewhere close? He wished that he could have got more instruction from Shadrach or Bigfoot about the best procedure to follow in such situations. They had fought Indians for years. They would know. So far, neither of them had said more than two words to him, and those were mostly comments about horseshoeing or some other chore. The lightning dimmed and dimmed as the storm moved east. Carl could see no trace of Gus, but of course between the lightning flashes the plain was pitch dark. Gus could be dead and scalped behind any of the sage bushes or clumps of chaparral. Carl walked back and forth a while, hoping Gus would hear him and call out. He decided shooting was unwise. If he shot any more, Major Chevalier might chide him for wasting the ammunition. Heartsick, sure that his friend was dead, Carl began to trudge back to camp. Felt it was mainly his fault that the tragedy had occurred. He should have fought Gus if necessary to keep him at his post, but he hadn't. Gus had walked off, and now all was lost. It seemed to Carl, as he walked back in dejection, that Gus should just have left him in the blacksmith's shop. He didn't know enough to be a ranger. Neither did his friend, and now ignorance had got Gus killed. Carl was certain he was dead, too. Gus had a loud voice, louder even than Black Sam's. If he wasn't dead, he would be making noise. And just as he was at the lowest ebb of dejection, Carl heard the very voice he had supposed he would never hear again. Gus McCrae's voice, yelling from the camp. Carl ran as hard as he could toward the sound. He came running into camp so fast that Long Bill Coleman nearly shot him for a hostel. Sure enough, though, there was Gus McCrae, alive and with his pants down. A Comanche lance protruded from his hip. The reason he was yelling was because Bigfoot and Shadrach were trying to pull it out. The lance was stuck so deep in Gus's hip that Bigfoot and Shadrach together couldn't pull it out. It was a long, heavy lance. How Gus had managed to run all that way with it dangling from his hip, Carl couldn't imagine. Gus kept yelling as the two men tugged at it. Rip Green tried to steady Gus as the two older men attempted to work the lance out. Rip alone wasn't strong enough. Bob Bascom had to come and help hold Gus in place. Shadrach soon grew annoyed with Gus's yelling, which was loud.
"Shut off your goddamn bellowing," Shadrach said. "You're yelling loud enough to call every Indian between here and the Cimarron River."
"There wasn't but one Indian," Carl informed him. "He had a big hump on his back. I seen him." At that news, the whole camp came to attention. Bigfoot and Shadrach ceased their efforts to extract the lance. Major Chevalier had been peering into the darkness, but his head snapped around when Carl mentioned the hump.
"You saw Buffalo Hump?" he said.
"He was the man who threw that lance," Carl said. "I saw him in the lightning flash. That was when he threw the lance. I thought he missed."
"Nope, he didn't miss," Bigfoot said. "This is his buffalo lance. I'm surprised he wasted it on a boy."
"I wish he hadn't," Gus said, his voice shaking. "I guess it's stuck in my hip bone."
"No, it's nowhere near your damn hip bone," Shadrach said.
He squatted to take a better look at the lance head. Then he waved Bigfoot away, twisted the lance a little, and with a hard yank pulled it out. Gus fainted. Rip and Bob had loosened their hold for a moment. Before they could recover, Gus fell forward on his face. Bob Bascom had looked aside in order to spit tobacco. He kept so much tobacco in his mouth that he was prone to choking fits in time of action. Rip Green had just glanced at his bedroll. He was suspicious by nature and was always glancing at his bedroll to make sure no one was stealing anything from it. Both Rip and Bob were startled when Gus fell on his face. Carl was, too. He had not supposed Gus McCrae would be the type to faint. But blood was pouring out of Gus's hip, and there seemed to be blood farther down his leg.
"Here, Sam," Major Chevalier said, motioning to his cook. "You're the doctor. Tend to this man before he bleeds to death."
"Need to get him closer to the fire so I can sew him up," Sam said.
He was a small man, about the size of Rip Green. His curly hair was white. Carl was uncomfortable with him.
He had little experience of darkies, but he had to admit that the man cooked excellent grub and seemed to be expert in treating boils and other small ailments. Sam quickly scooped some ash out of the campfire and used it to staunch the flow of blood. He patted ash into the wound until the bleeding stopped. While waiting for it to stop, he threaded a big darning needle. Matilda walked up about that time, dragging her pallet. Gus's yells had awakened her, and her mood was shaky. She kicked sand at Long Bill Coleman for no reason at all. The Mexican boy was asleep, but the old woman still sat by the fire, silent and unmoving.
"Sew that boy up before he gets conscious and starts bellowing again," Shadrach said. "If there's Indians around, they know where we are. This pup makes too much noise."
"While they can mark our position by the fire, they wouldn't need the yelling," Bigfoot said. Gus soon proved to be awake enough to be sensitive to the darning needle. It took Matilda and Bigfoot and Bob Bascom to hold him steady enough that Sam could sew up his long wound.
"Why'd you kick that sand on me?"
Long Bill asked Matilda while the sewing was in progress. He was a little hurt by Matilda's evident scorn.
"Because I felt like kicking sand on a son of a bitch," Matilda said. "You were the closest."
"This boy's lucky," Sam said. "The lance missed the bone."
"He might be lucky, but we ain't," Major Chevalier said. He was pacing around nervously. "What I can't figure out is why Buffalo Hump would be sitting out there by himself," he added.
"He was sitting on a blanket," Gus said.
Sam had finally quit poking him with the big needle. That and the fact that he was alive made him feel a little better. Besides that, he was back in camp. He felt sure he was going to survive and wanted to be helpful if he could.
"I ran right past him. That's why he took after me," Gus said. "He had a terrible big hump."
Gus felt that he might want to relax and snooze, but that plan was interrupted by the old Comanche woman who suddenly began to wail. The sound of her high wailing gave everybody a start.
"What's wrong with her? Now she's howling,"
Long Bill asked. Shadrach went over to the old woman and spoke with her in Comanche, but she continued to wail. Shadrach waited patiently until she stopped.
"She's a vision woman," Shadrach said. "My grandma was a vision woman, too. She would let out wails when she had some bad vision, just like this poor soul."
Call wanted the old woman to quiet down. Her wailing had a bad effect on the whole camp. Her wails were as sad as the sound of the wind as it sighed over the empty flats. He didn't want to hear such disturbing sounds, and none of the other rangers did either. Shadrach still squatted by the old woman, talking to her in his own tongue. The wind blew swirls of fine sand around him.
"Well, what now? What's she saying?" Major Chevalier asked.
"She says Buffalo Hump is going to cut off her nose," Shadrach said. "She was one of his father's wives. I guess she didn't behave none too well. Her people put her out to die, and Buffalo Hump heard about it. Now he wants to find her and cut off her nose."
"I'd think he had better things to do," the major said. "She's old. She'll die. Why bother with her nose?"
"Because she behaved bad to his father," Shadrach said a little impatiently.
Major Chevalier's ignorance of Indian habits often annoyed him.
"I don't like it that he's out there," Long Bill said. "Once he cuts this old woman's nose off, he might keep cutting. He might cut a piece or two off all of us before he stops."
"Well, if you're worried, just go kill him, Bill," Bigfoot said.
"He's a swift runner, even with that hump," Gus informed him. "He almost caught me, and I'm fleet."
Major Chevalier kept pacing back and forth, his pistol cocked.
"Let's mount up and go," he said abruptly. "We're not in a secure position here. I believe it would be best to ride."
"Now hold still," Shadrach insisted. "This is a vision woman talking. Let's see what else she has to say."
He went to the fire, poured some coffee in a tin cup, and handed it to the old woman. The major didn't like it that Shadrach had ignored his order, but he took it. He sat down by Matilda, who was still in a heavy mood.
"I still don't see why he would go to so much trouble just to cut off an old woman's nose," he muttered, mainly to himself.
Bigfoot Wallace heard him, though.
"You ain't a Comanche," Bigfoot said. "Comanches expect their wives to stay in the right tent."
Major Chevalier thought of his own dear wife, Jane. If it had not been for the scrape in Baltimore, he could be home with her right then. They might be nestled together in a nice feather bed. How long would it be before he could return to their snug stone house in Loudoun County? Would he ever return to it, or to his ardent Jane? He felt low, very low. It was too dusty in Texas. Every bite of food he had attempted to eat all day had been covered with grit. The large whore beside him was rough. She would never smell as good as his Jane. But Matilda was there, and Jane wasn't. Matilda was likable, despite being rough. The Major was feeling desperate. The Comanche war chief was within earshot of his camp. A minute's relief with Matilda would be helpful, but of course it was not a time to suggest to the troop that he was unmilitary. It was clear already that Bigfoot and Shadrach had a low opinion of his leadership. Chevalier was an old name, much respected in the Tidewater, but it meant nothing west of the Pecos. Ability was all that counted in the West, in such a country, among such men. Out west, the ability to waltz gracefully did not help a man keep his scalp. The fact was, he himself had no great opinion of his own military skills. His 3 weeks at the point had involved little study and none that touched on the fine points of warfare with Comanche Indians. Call went over and sat down by Gus. His friend seemed relaxed, if a little gaunt. "I seen you in the lightning," Call said. "I seen he was after you. I shot, but I doubt I hit him. He was after you hard." "Yes, and he nearly got me," Gus said. "I told you to stay put," Call reminded him, but in a low voice. He didn't want the Major to know that Gus had wandered off from his post, although if he hadn't, they might never have known that Buffalo Hump was nearby. "I didn't find no gold mine, just a badger and that big Indian," Gus admitted. "He was just sitting there on a blanket. What was he doing just sitting there with all that lightning striking?" When Shadrach finished talking to the old Comanche woman, he seemed a little agitated.
"What's the news, Shad?" Bigfoot asked.
He could tell there was some news. Shadrach had his rifle in his hand and he was looking north.
"Bad news," Shadrach said. "We need to watch our hair for the next few days. If we don't, we won't be wearing it."
"Why, Shad, I always watch my hair," Bob Bascom said.
Ezekiel whooped when he said it, and Josh Coyne smiled. The reason for their merriment was that Bob Bascom had almost no hair to watch. He was bald, except for a few sprigs above his ears. Blackie Slidell was almost as bald. He had been heard to remark that any Indian scalping him would mainly be wasting his time.
"Old Buffalo Hump would need a magnifying glass if he was to attempt to scalp either one of us, Bob," Blackie observed dryly.
"That old woman says a war is coming," Shadrach said.
"Well, maybe she is a vision woman," the Major said. "General Scott has been talking about taking Mexico, I hear."
"No, not that war," Shadrach said. "She ain't talking about no white war. She says the Comanches mean to attack someplace down in Mexico. I guess that would be Chihuahua City."
"Chihuahua City? Indians?" the Major exclaimed. "It would take a good number of braves to attack a city that size."
"It might not take that many," Bigfoot said.
"Why not?" the Major asked.
"Comanches are scary," Bigfoot said. "One Comanche brave on a lean horse can scare all the white people out of several counties. 50 Comanches could probably take Mexico City if they made a good run at it."
"That old woman ain't talking about 50 neither," Shadrach said. "She's talking about a passel. Hundreds, I reckon."
"Hundreds?" the Major said, startled.
Nobody, as far as he knew, had ever faced a force of hundreds of Comanches. Looking around at his troop, 12 men and one whore, he saw that most of the men were white-knuckled with fear as they gripped their rifles. The thought of hundreds of Comanches riding as one force was nothing any commander would care to contemplate. "That humpback man was there alone," Call said. He rarely spoke unless asked, but this time he thought he ought to remind the Major of what he had seen.
"It felt like 50 or 100, though, while he was after me," Gus said, sitting up.
"You said he was just sitting on a blanket?" Bigfoot asked.
"Yes, just sitting," Gus said. "He was on a little hill. I guess it was mostly just a hump of sand."
"Maybe he was waiting for Gomez," Bigfoot said. "That would explain my dream."
"No, that's wild," Shadrach said. "If he's got hundreds of warriors coming, he wouldn't need to wait for no Apache."
"I've dreamt prophecy before," Bigfoot insisted. "I think he was waiting for Gomez. I expect they mean to take Chihuahua City together and divide up the captives."
"My Lord, if there's hundreds of them coming, they'll hunt us up and hack us all down," Long Bill said.
He had been nursing a sense of grievance. After all, he had ridden off from San Antonio to help find a good road west, not to be hacked to pieces by Comanche Indians.
"It wouldn't need to be hundreds to take us," Bigfoot corrected. 25 would be plenty, and 10 or 15 could probably do the job."
"Now that's a useless comment," Bob Bascom said, hurt by Bigfoot's low estimation of the troops' fighting ability.
"I expect we could handle 15, he added.
"Not unless lightning struck half of them," Bigfoot said.
"I was watching you youngsters take target practice yesterday. Half of you couldn't hit your foot if your gun barrel was resting on it."
Shadrach conversed a little more with the old woman. When he finished, she began to wail again. The sound was so irritating that Call felt like putting cotton in his ears, but he had no cotton.
"She don't know nothing about Gomez," Shadrach said. "I think your darn dream was off."
"We'll see," Bigfoot said. He didn't press the issue, not with Shadrach, a man who trusted no opinions except his own. Gus McCrae got to his feet. He wanted to test his leg in case he had to run again. He walked slowly over and picked up his rifle. His hip didn't hurt much, but he felt uneasy in his stomach. When the lance stuck in his hip, he saw it rather than felt it. He was even able to hold the shaft of the lance off the ground as he ran. Now, even in the midst of his fellow rangers, the fear he felt then wouldn't leave him. He had the urge to hide someplace. Gus had never supposed he would run from any man, yet he felt as if he could still be running. He needed to get farther from Buffalo Hump than he was, and as fast as he could. He just didn't know where to run. Matilda thought the tall Tennessee boy looked a little green around the gills. Though she was stiff with Gus when he importuned her, she liked the boy and winced when the lance was being pulled out. He was a lively boy, brash but not really bad. Once or twice she'd even extended him credit. He seemed to need it so, and a minute or less did for him usually. She could occasionally spare a minute for a brash boy with a line of gab. "Sit down, Gussie," she said. "You oughtn't to be exercising too much just yet."
"Let him exercise. It might keep that leg from stiffening up," the major said. "It's a good thing that wound bled like it did."
"Yes, good," Sam said. "Otherwise he'd be dying soon."
"Comanches dipped their lances in dog shit," Bigfoot informed him. "You don't want to get that much dog inside you if you can help it. Better to bleed it out."
"Sit down, Gussie," Matilda said again. "Sit down by me unless you don't like me anymore." Gus hobbled over and sat down by Matilda. He was a little surprised that she had been so inviting. It wasn't that he didn't like her anymore. It was that he liked her too much. For a moment he had an urge to throw himself into Matilda's lap and cry. Of course, such an action would be the ruin of him among the hardened rangers. Rather than cry, he scooted as close to Matilda's comforting bulk as he could get without actually sitting in her lap. He gulped a time or two, but managed not to break down and sob. He saw old Shadrach mount his horse and ride off into the darkness. Shadrach said not a word, and no one tried to stop him or ask him where he was going.
"Doesn't he know that big Comanche with the hump is still out there?"
Gus asked. He felt the old man must be completely daft to ride into the darkness with such an Indian near. Call, too, was shocked by Shadrach's departure. Buffalo Hump was out there, and even Shadrach would be no match for him. No one Call knew would be a match for him, not alone. Call felt sure of that, although he had only seen the man for a second in the flash of a lightning strike. But Shadrach left, with no one offering him a word of caution. Bigfoot didn't seem to give Shadrach's departure a second thought, and Major Chevalier merely frowned a little when he saw the mountain man ride away.
"What now, Major?"
Ezekiel Moody asked. It was a question everyone would have liked an answer to, but Major Chevalier ignored the question. He said nothing. Ezekiel looked at Josh Korn, and Josh Korn looked at Rip Green. Long Bill looked at Bob Bascom, who looked at One-Eyed Johnny Carthage.
"Now, where would Shad be going this time of night?" Johnny asked. "It's no time to be exercising your mount, not if it means leaving the troop, not if you ask me."
"I didn't hear Shad ask you, Johnny," Bigfoot said. "That's twice today he's left, though," the major said. "It's vexing."
Bigfoot walked over to the edge of the camp, lay flat down, and pressed his ear to the ground.
"Is he listening for worms? Does he mean to fish?"
Gus asked Call, perplexed by Bigfoot's behavior.
"No, he's listening for horses. Comanche horses," Matilda said. "Shut up and let him listen."
Bigfoot soon stood up and came back to the fire.
"Nobody's coming right this minute," he said. "If there were hundreds of horses on the move, I'd hear them. That don't mean they won't show up tomorrow, though," he added.
"Why tomorrow?" several men asked at once.
Tomorrow was only an hour or two away.
"Full moon," Bigfoot said. "It's what they call the Comanche moon. They like to raid into Mexico down this old war trail when the moon is full. They like that old Comanche moon."
Major Chevalier knew he had only about an hour in which to decide on a course of action. Of course, the old woman might be daft. There might be no plan to raid Chihuahua City, and no great war party, hundreds of warriors strong, headed down from the Llano Estacado to terrorize the settlements in Mexico and Texas. Might all simply be the ravings of an old woman who was afraid of having her nose cut off. But if what the old woman said was true, then the settlements needed to be warned. That many warriors moving south would threaten the whole frontier. All the farms west of the Austin-San Antonio line would be vulnerable. Even half a dozen warriors split off from the main branch could burn homesteads, steal children, and generally wreak havoc. The devil of it was that they were just at the midpoint of their exploration, as far from the settlements to the east as they were from the pass of the north. Striking on west to El Paso might be the safest option for his troop. The war trail ran well east of El Paso. On the other hand, Buffalo Hump already knew they were there, and knew he was only up against a few men. If he had a large force at his disposal, he might pursue them simply for his pleasure. He no doubt knew that the two scalp hunters were with them. Scalping a scalp hunter was a pursuit that would interest any Indian, Comanche or Apache. Turning east would mean the end of their mission, and they were only a week or two from completing it, and would also take them directly across the path of the raiders, if there were raiders. They would have to depend on speed and luck if they turned east. What was certain was that a decision had to be made, made soon. He had no shackles on his men. Rangers mostly served because they wanted to. If they stopped wanting to, they might all do what Shadrach had just done. They might just ride off. The youngsters, Call and McCrae, would stay, of course. They were too green to strike out for themselves. But the more experienced men were unlikely to sit around and wait for his decision much past sunup. The sight of the buffalo lance sticking out of Augustus McCrae's hip was vivid in their minds. They wouldn't be inclined to play cards or solicit Matilda or shoot at cactus pods, not with a big war party swooping down the plains toward them. The major sighed. Going to jail in Baltimore was beginning to look like it might have some advantages. He walked over to Bigfoot. The tall scout was idly chewing on a chaparral twig.
"That old woman's blind," the major said. "Do you think she was right about the raiding party? Maybe Shadrach misunderstood her about the figures. Maybe she was talking about some raid that took place 30 years ago.
Bigfoot spat out the twig. "Maybe," he said, "but maybe not." Bigfoot was thinking about how lucky the two young rangers were, young Gus particularly. To walk right up on Buffalo Hump and live to tell about it was luck not many men could claim. Even to have seen the humpback chief was more than many experienced men could claim. He himself had glimpsed Buffalo Hump once, in a sleet storm near the Clear Fork of the Brazos several years earlier. He'd stepped out of a little post-oak thicket and looked up to see the humpback chief aiming an arrow at him. Just as Buffalo Hump loosed the arrow, Bigfoot stepped on an ice-glazed root and lost his footing. The arrow glanced off the bowie knife stuck in his belt. He rolled and brought his rifle up, but by the time he did, the Comanche was gone. That night, afraid to make a fire for fear Buffalo Hump would find him, he almost froze. The large feet that produced his nickname turned as numb as stone. Now the major was stumping about trying to convince himself that Shadrach and the old Comanche woman were wrong about the raiding party. The men were scared, and with good reason. The major had still not been able to think of an order to give.
"Damn it, I hate to double back," the major said. "I was aiming to wet my whistle in El Paso."
He mounted and walked his sorrel slowly around the camp for a few minutes. The horse was unlikely to crow-hop on nippy mornings. Shadrach came back while he was riding slowly around. Settling his horse gave the major time to think, and time also to ease his head a little. He was prone to headaches and had suffered one most of the night. But the sun was just rising. It looked to be a fine morning. His spirits improved, and he decided to go on west. Turning back didn't jibe with his ambitions. If he found a clear route to El Paso, he might be made a colonel. Or a general, even.
"Let's go, boys. It's west," he said, riding back to the campfire. "We were sent to find a road, so let's go find it."
The rangers had survived a terrifying night. As soon as they mounted, warmed by the sun, many of them got sleepy and nodded in their saddles. Gus's wounded hip was paining him. Walking wasn't easy, but riding was hard, too. His black nag had a stiff trot. He kept glancing across the sage flats, expecting to see Buffalo Hump rise up from behind a sage bush. The scalp hunters, Kirker and Glanton, rode half a mile with the troop and then turned their horses.
"Ain't you coming, boys?" Long Bill asked.
The scalp hunters didn't answer. Once the pack mules passed, they rode toward Mexico.
"There ain't many soldiers that know what they're doing, are they, Shad?" Bigfoot asked. "This major sure don't." "I doubt he's a major or even a soldier," Shadrach said. "I expect he just stole a uniform."
Bigfoot suspected Shadrach was right. Probably Major Chevalier had just stolen a uniform.
Texas was the sort of place where people could simply name themselves something and then start being whatever they happened to name. Then they could start acquiring the skills of their new profession, or not acquiring them, as the case might be.
Well, I ain't a soldier boy neither, Shadrach said.
Was you ever a soldier? Bigfoot asked. He was looking up at a crag, or a little hump of mountain a few miles to the north. In the clear, dry air, he thought he saw a spot of white on the mountain, which was puzzling. What could be white on a mountain far west of the Pecos?
Shadrach ignored Bigfoot's question. He didn't answer questions about his past.
See that white speck up on that hill? Bigfoot asked. Shadrach looked but saw nothing. Bigfoot was singular for the force of his vision, which was one reason he was sought after as a scout.
He was not careful or meticulous, not by Shadrach's standards, but there was no denying that he could see a long way.
I swear I think it's mountain goat, Bigfoot said. I never heard of mountain goat in Texas, but there it is, and it's white.
He immediately forgot his vexation with the major and his excitement at spotting what he was now sure must be a mountain goat, a creature he had heard of but never previously seen. After a little more looking, he thought he spotted a second goat, not far from the first one.
Look, boys, it's mountain goats, he informed the startled rangers, most of whom were straggling along half asleep.
At Bigfoot's cry, excitement instantly flashed through the troop. Rangers with weak vision, such as One-Eyed Johnny Carthage or Little Rip Green, could barely see the mountain, much less the goats, but that didn't weaken their excitement. Within a minute, the whole troop was racing toward the humpy mountain, where the two goats, invisible to everyone but Bigfoot, were thought to be grazing. Only Matilda and Black Sam resisted the impulse to race wildly off. They continued at a steady pace. The old Comanche woman and the tongueless boy followed on a pack mule.
Gus and Carl were racing along with the rest of the troop, their horses running flat out through the thin sage. Gus forgot the throb of his wounded hip in the excitement of the race.
What do they think they're going to do, Sam? Fly up that mountain? Matilda asked.
From the level plain, the sides of the mountain where the goats were seemed far too steep for horses to climb.
Sam was wishing Texas wasn't so big and open. You could look and look as far as you could see, and there would be nothing to give you encouragement. He had been in jail for dropping a watermelon when Bigfoot happened to get locked up. He had picked a watermelon off a stall and thumped it to see if it was ripe, but then he dropped it and it burst on the cobblestones. The merchant demanded 10 cents for his burst melon, but Sam only had 3 cents. He offered to work off the difference, but the merchant had him arrested instead.
The cook in the San Antonio jail got so drunk that he let a wagon run over his foot and crush it, making him too sick to cook. Sam was offered his job and took it. He had known how to cook since he was 6. Bigfoot liked grub so much that he suggested Sam to Major Chevalier, who promptly paid the debt of 7 cents and took Sam with him. Now here he was, in the biggest country he had ever seen, with a horizon so distant that his eyes didn't want to seek it, and a sun so bright that he could only tolerate it by pulling the brim of his old cap down over his eyes. He was riding along with a whore after a bunch of irritable white men who had decided to chase goats. At least the whore was friendly, even if she did eat snapping turtle for breakfast. The rangers, young Gus in the lead, had raced to the foot of the mountain, only to discover at close range what Matilda had discerned at a distance. The little mountain was much too steep for horses and perhaps even too steep for men. Now that they were directly underneath the crag, they couldn't see the goats either. They were hidden by rocks and boulders somewhere above them. Also, their horses were winded from the chase. The mountain that in the clear air had looked so close had actually been several miles away. Many of the horses, skinny nags mostly, were stumbling and shaking by the time the rangers dismounted. Carl had never seen a mountain before, although of course he was familiar with hills. This mountain went straight up. If you could get on top of it, you wouldn't be very far from the sky. But they weren't at the top of it. They were at the bottom, near several good-sized boulders that had toppled off at some point and rolled out onto the plain. Major Chevalier, like most of his men, had enjoyed the wild race immensely. After all the worry and indecision, it was a relief just to race a horse at top speed over the plain. Besides, if they could bring down a mountain goat or two, there would be meat for the pot. He had often hunted in Virginia, deer mostly, bear occasionally, and of course turkeys and geese, but he had never been in sight of a western mountain goat and was anxious to get in a shot before someone beat him to the game. Several of the men had already grabbed their rifles and were ready to shoot. Josh Korn got off his horse and vomited to the general amusement.
Josh had a delicate constitution. He could never ride fast for any length of time without losing his breakfast. It was an impediment to what he hoped would be a fine career in the Rangers.
"Boys, let's climb," Bigfoot said. "These goats ain't likely to fall off the hill."
Long Bill Coleman was the pessimist in the crowd. He was too nearsighted to have seen the goats. In fact, he could not see far up the mountain at all. His horse was in better shape than most because of his lack of confidence in the hunt. He had held the pony to a lope while the others were running flat out. Unlike the rest of the command, Long Bill had not forgotten that there were Comanches in the area. He was more interested in seeing that he had a mount fresh enough to carry him away from Comanches than he was in shooting goats. The latter, in his experience, were hard to chew anyway. Worse than hard if the goat happened to be an old Billy. Matilda and Black Sam came trotting up to the base of the cliff where the hunting party was assembling itself. The only one to venture up the cliff was young McCrae, who had climbed some 30 yards up when his wounded leg gave out suddenly.
"Look out, he's falling," Bob Bascom said.
Call felt embarrassed, for indeed his friend was falling, or rather rolling, down the steep slope he had just climbed up. Gus tried to grab for a little bush to check his descent, but he missed and rolled all the way down, ending up beneath Major Chevalier's horse, which abruptly began to pitch. The major had dropped his reins in order to adjust the sights on his rifle. To his intense annoyance, the horse suddenly bolted and went dashing across the plain to the west.
"Now look, you young fool, who told you to climb?" the major exploded. "Now you run off my horse!"
Gus McCrae was so embarrassed he couldn't speak. One minute he'd been climbing fine, the next minute he was rolling. Call was just as embarrassed. The major was red in the face with anger. In all likelihood, he was about to fire Gus on the spot. There was a funny side to the spectacle, though. The sight of Gus rolling over and over set many of the Rangers to slapping their thighs and laughing. Matilda was cackling, and even Sam chuckled. Call was on the point of laughing, too, but restrained himself out of consideration for his friend. Matilda laughed so loudly that Tom, her horse, usually a stolid animal, began to hop around and act as if he might throw her. "Dern," Gus said, so stricken with embarrassment that he could not think of another word to say. Though he had rolled all the way down the hill, his rifle had only rolled part way. It was lodged against a rock 20 yards above them.
"Get mounted, you damn scamp, and go bring my horse back before he runs himself out of sight," the major commanded. "You can get that rifle when you come back."
Several rangers, Ezekiel Moody among them, were watching the horse run off. All of them were in a high state of hilarity. Rip Green was laughing so hard he could hardly stand up. Everyone except Major and Gus were enjoying the little moment of comic relief when suddenly they saw the major's horse go down.
"Prairie dog hole, I hope his leg's not broken," Johnny Carthage said.
Before he could even finish saying it, the sound of a shot echoed off the mountain behind him. "No prairie dog hole. That horse was shot," Bigfoot said. Shadrach immediately led his horse behind one of the larger boulders.
"My God, now what?" the major said.
All he had taken off his saddle was the rifle itself. His ammunition and all his kit were with the fallen horse. No one said a word. The plain before them looked as empty as it had when they had all come racing across it. There was no sign of anyone. Two hawks circled in the sky. The fallen horse did not rise again. The rangers, all of them ready to pop off a few shots at some mountain goats, were caught in disarray. Young Josh Korn, having just emptied his stomach, found that he needed to empty his bowels, too, and walked down the slope some 30 yards to a little bunch of sage bushes. Most of the rangers had no qualms about answering calls of nature in full view of a crowd, but Josh liked a little privacy. He had just undone his breeches when Gus rolled down the hill, but his call was urgent. He was squatting down amid the sage bushes when the major's horse bolted. He heard the shot that killed the horse, but supposed it was only some ranger popping off a long shot at one of the goats. For a moment his cramping bowels occupied all his attention. Ever since gulping a bellyful of Pecos water, he had been afflicted with cramps of such severity that from time to time he was forced to dismount and pour out fluids so alkaline that they turned white in the sun. Josh kept squatting, emptying himself of more Pecos salts. He was in no rush to get back to the crowd. The cramps were still bad, so bad that he could only have walked bending over, which would only have made him an object of derision to his fellows. Besides, he could tell from looking at the cliff that he was too weak to make it up very far. Unless he was lucky, someone else would have to shoot the goats. Josh had just reached over to strip a few sage leaves to wipe himself with when he saw a movement in the sage some 15 yards away. All he could see was the back of an animal.
He thought it must be a pig, moving through the thickest part of the little patch of sage and chaparral.
Josh reached for his pistol. The pig would come in sight in just a moment, and he meant to empty his pistol into it. The other rangers could go scampering up the mountain to shoot at goats if they wanted to. He would be the one bringing home meat, pig meat. They had feasted on several javelinas on the trip from San Antonio. Some had been tough, others succulent. When there was time, Sam liked to bury the whole pig, head, hide, and all, overnight with coals heaped on it. By morning, the pig would be plenty tender. Sam would dig it up, and the rangers would enjoy a fine meal. Buffalo Hump had been watching the boy. When the young ranger started to reach for his pistol, Buffalo Hump rose to his knees and fired an arrow just above the tops of the sage. Josh Korn saw him only for a split second before the arrow cut through his throat and severed his windpipe. Josh dropped his pistol and managed to get a hand on the arrow, but he fell sideways as he grasped it and didn't feel the knife that finished cutting his throat. Buffalo Hump dragged the quivering body behind him as he retreated through the sage. Kicking Wolf had just shot the major's horse. All the rangers were looking across the plain. They had forgotten the boy who was emptying his bowels amid the sage. Buffalo Hump had his horse staked in a shallow gully. As soon as he got the dead boy into the gully, he stripped him, cut off his privates, and threw him on the back of his horse. A curtain of blood from the cut throat covered the boy's torso. Buffalo Hump mounted, but kept low. He held the streaming corpse across the horse's rump with one hand. He waited, looking to see if the rangers were inclined to mount and go investigate the sudden death of the major's horse. He had watched the rangers closely the day of the sandstorm, and felt he knew what the capability of the little force was. The only man he had to watch was old Shadrach, known to the Comanches as Tail of the Bear. The long rifle of Tail of the Bear had to be respected. The old man seldom missed. Bigfoot Wallace was quick and strong, but no shot. Buffalo Hump regretted not having killed him the day of the great ice storm on the Clear Fork of the Brazos. The fat major was a good shot with a pistol, but seldom used a rifle. Buffalo Hump waited, while the blood from Josh Korn's corpse ran down his horse's rear legs and soaked his flanks. In their haste to kill mountain goats, in fact, two Comanche boys with goat skins over their shoulders, the rangers had foolishly run their horses down. In their eagerness, the rangers had also outrun the old woman and the tongueless boy. He himself had already caught the old woman and notched her nose to pay back the insult she had given his father. The tongueless boy he had given to Kicking Wolf, who would sell him as a slave. There had been much ammunition on the pack mule, too. The rangers would soon be out of bullets if they started shooting. He had slipped into the gully merely to watch the white men at close range, but then the careless young ranger walked into the sage to empty his bowels. Taking him had been easier than snaring a prairie dog or killing a turkey. Once he was satisfied that the whites were not going as a troop to find the killer of the major's horse, Buffalo Hump burst out of the gully. He yelled his war cry as loudly as he could and raced directly in front of the whites, still holding the bloody corpse across the rump of his horse. He saw a bullet kick the dust, well short of where he rode. Old Tail of the Bear was shooting low. Even so, Buffalo Hump slid to the offside of his mount, one hand gripping the mane, one leg hooked over the horse. The old man would keep shooting, and he might not always shoot low. Then, in plain sight of the rangers, Buffalo Hump regained his seat, took the corpse of Josh Korn by one foot, and flung it high in the air. Then he whirled to face the whites for a few seconds, screaming his defiance. When he saw bullets kicking dust at his horse's feet, he turned and rode slowly out of range. At the base of the steep mountain, the rangers were stunned and in disarray.
"Where's that old woman?" the major asked. He remembered suddenly that in their haste to get to the mountain, they had run off and left the pack mule that was carrying the old woman and boy. He remembered, too, that most of their ammunition was on that mule. The major looked around and saw that no one had even heard his question. All the rangers had scrambled to take cover behind the few boulders or the scarce bushes. Gus and Carl were huddled behind a rock, but it wasn't really a boulder and didn't hide them very well. Both of them looked around for a bigger rock, but all the bigger rocks had rangers huddled behind them. The major himself got behind the other pack mule, the only cover available. The cry that Buffalo Hump yelled as he raced across the desert was far worse in Carl's view than the wailing of the old Comanche woman. Buffalo Hump's war cry throbbed with hatred, terrible hatred.
when the Comanche whirled to face them and flung a naked white body streaked with blood up in the air, both boys were shocked. "Why, he's killed somebody," Gus said in a shaking tone. Carl was more shocked by how bloody the corpse was. Whoever it was, and he could see that it was a white man, had poured out a terrible lot of blood.
"Where's young Josh?" Bigfoot asked. He had a bad feeling suddenly. "I don't see young Josh anywhere."
Ezekiel Moody gave a start. He and Josh Cornyn were best friends. They had joined up with the Rangers on a whim. Zeke looked around at the various Rangers crouched behind such cover as they could get. He saw no sign of his friend.
"Why, he was right here," Zeke said, standing up. "I think he just walked off to take a shit. He's been having the runs."
"Foolish," the Major said.
He couldn't spot the boy either and got a weak feeling suddenly in his gut.
"He's been poorly in his belly since he drank that alky water,"
Zeke protested. He was sure Josh wasn't doing anything wrong.
"I wasn't talking about Josh when I said it was foolish," the Major said.
He had been talking about himself. One glimpse of a mountain goat, Bigfoot's glimpse at that, had encouraged them to make a wild charge and exhaust their horses. The thought of a hunt had been something to break the monotony of plodding on west. Well, there was no monotony now. The Comanches had really broken it. Now they were backed against a cliff. His horse was dead and possibly a boy, too.
"I think that was Josh he pitched up in the air," Bigfoot said. "I think that sneaking devil caught him."
"No, it can't be Josh," Zeke said, suddenly very distraught. "Josh just went over in them bushes to take a shit."
"I think he caught him, Zeke," Bigfoot said in a kindly tone. He knew the boys were friends.
"Oh, no. All that blood," Zeke said.
Before anyone could stop him, he jumped on his horse and went riding off toward the spot where Buffalo Hump had thrown the body.
"Hell, where's that pup going?"
Shadrach said. He came walking up, disgusted with himself for having been tricked into such a situation. He hadn't expected to hit Buffalo Hump when he shot unless he was lucky, and he didn't intend to waste any more bullets in the hope of being lucky. He might need every bullet. Likely would. Just as he was walking up to the group, he thought he saw movement. The movement had been an arrow which thudded into Bigfoot's horse. The horse squealed and reared. The arrow had come from above, from the mountain.
"They're above us," Shadrach yelled. "Get them horses out of range."
"Oh, damn it, it wasn't goats, it was Comanches," Bigfoot said, mortified that he'd been so easily taken in. He began to drag his wounded horse farther from the hill. Arrows began to fly off the mountain, though no one could spot the Indians who were shooting them. Several rangers shot at the mountain to no effect. Three horses were hit, and one-eyed Johnny Carthage got an arrow in his upper leg. Carl had an arrow just glance off his elbow. He knew he was lucky. The horses were in a panic. He had no time to think about anything except hanging on to his mount. The rangers all retreated toward the patch of sagebrush where Josh Cornyn had been taken. It was Carl dragging his rearing horse by the bridle who spotted the bloody patch of ground where Josh had been killed. Carl knew it must be Josh's blood because the shit on the ground was white. His own had mostly been white since crossing the Pecos. "Look," he said to Gus, who was just behind him. At the sight of all the fresh blood, the strength suddenly drained out of Gus. He dropped to his knees and began to vomit, letting go of his horse's reins in the process. The horse had an arrow sticking out of its haunch and was jumpy. Carl just managed to catch a rein and keep the horse from bolting. Long Bill and Rip Green were shooting at the Comanches on the hill, although they couldn't see their targets.
"Hold off shooting, you idiots," Bigfoot yelled. "You ain't going to hit an Indian 1,000 feet up a mountain."
Bigfoot felt very chagrined. He knew he ought to have been able to tell a goatskin with a Comanche boy under it from a living goat, and he could have if he had just had the patience to ride a little closer and observe the goats as they grazed. His lack of patience had led the Rangers into a trap. Of course, he hadn't expected the pell-mell rush to shoot goats, but he should have expected it. Most rangers would ride half a day to shoot any game, much less unusual game such as mountain goats. Now, one was dead, several horses were hurt, a ranger had an arrow in his leg, Zeke Moody had just foolishly ridden off, and no one had any idea how many Indians they faced. There were several on the mountain and at least two on the plain, one of them Buffalo Hump, no mean opponent. But there could be 40. Or even more than 40. In his hurry to get to the mountain, he had paid no attention to sign. At least Matilda and Sam had not been cut off. The fact that they had survived probably meant they weren't dealing with a large party. The loss of the ammunition that was on the other pack mule was a grievous loss, though. The next worry was Ezekiel Moody, who was still loping off to locate the body of his friend. Bigfoot knew that Zeke would soon be dead or captured, unless he was very lucky.
"Damn that boy, they'll take him for sure," the major said.
All the rangers, plus Matilda and Sam, were huddled in the little patch of sage. Shadrach saw the gully where Buffalo Hump had tethered his horse and found the bloody trail he had made when he dragged Josh Korn's body. Gus had the dry heaves. He could not stop retching. The sight of the Indian with the great hump reminded him of his own terrified flight. The smell of Josh Korn's blood caused his stomach to turn over and over like a churn. Gus knew that Buffalo Hump had almost caught him. The sight of Josh's blood-streaked body showed him clearly what his fate would have been had the lance that struck his hip been thrown a little more accurately. A yard or so difference in the foot race and he would have been as dead as Josh. Gus finally got to his feet and stumbled a little distance from the blood. He needed to steady himself so he could shoot if the Comanches launched an attack. Major Chevalier felt that he had decided foolishly. He should have followed his first instinct and headed east. More and more he regretted not taking his chances with the Baltimore judge. Now he was caught in an exposed place with only a shallow gully for cover and an unknown number of savages in opposition. Their best hope lay in the skills of the two scouts. Shadrach was calm, if annoyed, and Bigfoot was flustered, no doubt because he knew he was responsible for getting them into such a fix. His superior eyesight had not been superior enough to detect the trick and prevent the race. The chaos involved in fighting such Indians bothered Randall Chevalier more than anything. In Virginia, or even Pennsylvania, if quarrels arose, a man usually knew who he was fighting and how to proceed. But in the West, with a few puny men caught between vast horizons, it was different. The Indians always knew the country better than the white men. They knew how to use it, to hide in it, to survive in it, in places where a white man would have no chance. No man in Virginia would ride around with a naked, bloody corpse bouncing around on the rump of his horse. No one in Virginia or Pennsylvania would yell as Buffalo Hump had yelled. There was another shot from the hidden rifleman on the plain, and Zeke Moody's horse went down. "I feared it. They'll get him now, the young fool," Bigfoot said. Zeke was not hurt. He had heard no shot and supposed his horse had merely stumbled. But the horse didn't get up. In a moment, Zeke realized that the horse was dead. At once he turned and began to run toward the mountain and the rangers. But Zeke had scarcely run 10 yards before Buffalo Hump loomed behind him, riding a horse whose sides were bloody with Josh Korn's blood. "We better go help him," Call said, but old Shadrach grabbed his arm before he could move.
"All this damn helping's got to stop," Shadrach said. "We don't know how many of them are out there. If we don't stay together, there won't be a man of us left."
"There's no chance for that boy anyway," the major said grimly. "I should have shot his horse myself before he got out of range. That way we could have saved the boy."
All the rangers watched the desperate race helplessly. They saw that what the major said was true. Ezekiel Moody had no chance. Old Shadrach raised his long rifle in case Buffalo Hump strayed in range, but he didn't expect it, and he didn't fire.
"I hope he remembers what I told him about killing himself," Bigfoot said. "He'd be better off to stop running and kill himself. It'd be the easiest thing."
Ezekiel Moody had the same thought. He was running as fast as his legs could carry him, but when he looked back, he saw that the Indian with the great hump was closing fast. Ezekiel's heart was beating so hard with fear that he was afraid it might burst. He had just come upon Josh Korn's body when his horse went down. He had seen the great red cap of blood where Josh's scalp had been. He had also seen the bloody arrow protruding from Josh's throat. Yet he was afraid to stop running and try to kill himself. He was afraid the Comanche would be on him before he could even get his pistol out. Also, he was getting close enough to the rangers that one of them might make a lucky shot and hit Buffalo Hump, or turn him. Old Shadrach had been known to make some remarkable shots. Maybe if he just kept running, one of the rangers would get off a good long shot. Then abruptly, Zeke changed his mind and gave up. He stopped and tried to yank out his pistol and shove it against his eyeball, as Bigfoot had instructed. He knew the Indian on the bloody horse was almost on him. He knew he had to be quick. But when he got his pistol out, he turned to glance at the charging Indian, and the pistol dropped out of his sweaty hand. Before he could stoop for it, the horse and the Indian were there. He had failed. He was caught. Buffalo Hump reached down and grabbed the terrified boy by his long black hair. He yanked his horse to a stop,
lifted Zeke Moody off his feet and slashed at his head with a knife just above the boy's ears. Then he whirled and raced across the front of the huddled rangers, dragging Zeke by the hair. As the horse increased its speed, the scalp tore loose, and Zeke fell free. Buffalo Hump had whirled again and held aloft the bloody scalp. Then he turned and rode away slowly at a walk.